Welcome, everyone, to the United Lodge of Theosophists in Philadelphia. We are Zooming from Theosophy Hall today, as well as having in-house meetings. We do it just on Sundays, and we just wanted to remind everybody that we are open on Sundays to have fellow attendees actually come in. And for those that actually do come, we want to thank you for in an effort to maintain a fragrance-free zone for the benefit of those with sensitivities. And of course, we've all been very happy with the ability to Zoom during these pandemic times. We've been able to keep these ideas, you know, spread, broadcasting them, and keeping contact with our fellow companions. So we just ask that everyone follow a few certain Zoom etiquette rules, mainly keeping your microphone muted and when you're not speaking. And if you're going to be, you know, up and around in your home while you're attending the meeting, to please put yourself with your video off, as people moving around, it can be rather distracting to others. So it's been comforting, as we said, to have everybody here during the pandemic. We just ask that we recall the ULT declaration that the meetings maintain anonymity, no crosstalk, side issues, or personal anecdotes. And if one is going to make a comment or ask a question, to please speak directly to the chairperson when called upon. By keeping these traditions, it creates a safe space for others who might feel a little insecure about sharing in public. So we do ask that we keep distractions, and we just keep to these ideas, to the philosophy during the meetings. So we just ask for everyone to work to maintain these traditions. So the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, and just so that everyone knows, that the United Lodge of Theosophists, all of us, all the lodges are bound together in spirit by these few words. And wherever you go in the world to a United Lodge, you will find this declaration being read. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. In order for the United Lodge here at Theosophy Hall in Philadelphia to accomplish these goals put forth by the Declaration, we do have three meetings a week. As today on Sunday, we have a choice of one of three types of meetings. Today we're having a forum, which is a short talk and then followed by questions and answers. We have lectures, which are longer talks, again, followed by questions and discussion. And then we have panel discussions, and again, always followed by questions and discussion. The Sunday meetings begin from 11 until 12. If you're coming into Theosophy Hall, the doors open at 10:30, and the meeting runs from 11 until 12. There's always an overview of, there's always an umbrella topic for each Sunday month. And this month we've been looking at the path of spiritual evolution. Today, our meeting title is Slaying the Illusions of Mind. Last week, it was Silencing the Chattering Mind. And next week, the Victorious Virtuous Mind. So we can see a pattern this month of how things can progress on that spiritual evolution. Next month, the overall umbrella topic will be the keys of virtue, the paramitas. So on Wednesdays then, we are in Mr. Judge's Ocean of Theosophy, and we are still following the information he is giving us on reincarnation. We're not sure what the chapter is though, but it is on reincarnation, and invitations, of course, will be coming out the day before each and every class. And our Wednesday class is Zoom only, and it runs from 7:30 until 8:45. On Fridays, we are looking at Mr. Judge's Echoes from the Orient. Class starts at 6:30, runs until 7:30, and it also is Zoom only. So we hope that we will see some of you on Zoom here, and we'll, The United Lodge of Theosophists is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings in time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. So we do want to just start the meeting from Mr. Judge, his article, which can be found in his volume one of his articles. It's called Mental Discipline. Then memory of many objects, things, subjects, duties, persons, circumstances, and affairs bring up before it the various pictures and thoughts belonging to them. After these, the mind at once tries to go, and we find ourselves wandering from the point. It must hence follow that the storing of a multiplicity of useless and surely recurring thoughts is an obstacle to the acquirement of truth. And this obstacle is the very one peculiar to our present style of life. And he wrote this back in the late 1800s, and we know that even now, this is still going on in this style of life. And we think that many of us can relate to this title, which is Slaying the Illusions of Mind, because there are so many distractions in this day and age that we surely can use the suggestions and the explanations that we're going to hear today on our class discussions and from the forum reading that will happen momentarily. And we just got a chat. We think it was the, the Ocean class. Thank you very much. Is chapter 9, Heredity as Proof. So we just want to read from the voice in regards to the forum reading that will occur shortly, and it's on page 13. Strive with thy thoughts unclean before they overpower thee. Use them as they will thee. For if thou sparest them and they take root and grow, know well these thoughts will overpower and kill thee. Beware, disciple, suffer not, even though it be their shadow to approach, for it will grow. Increase in size and power, and then this thing of darkness will absorb thy being before thou hast well realized the black foul monster's presence. So we can see then that we really need to work on raising up our minds and hearts. So we will now have the forum reading.
In a great article by E.P. Wadia entitled The Slayer of the Real, from his larger work called Studies in the Voice of the Silence, he explains illusions of mind beautifully as follows. When esoteric philosophy calls the world of objects illusory, it means that it is not in the sense that the objects do not exist, but in the sense that our valuation of them is false. The objective world may well be compared to a great bazaar in which desire-enslaved minds, not knowing the true prices of things, are taken in, have to bargain, to haggle, and to wrangle for things needed, and have to be tempted to want and to acquire other things. The mind thus exploited in the bazaar of the objective world gains experience and learns to evaluate each object at its proper worth, and then, and not before then, man begins to live in that world. Theosophy teaches that each and every human being is first and foremost a universal spiritual essence, one with the absolute, eternal, unchanging, boundless, and immutable. At the same time, we are also a sevenfold mind being. What distinguishes us from all the kingdoms of nature below is the presence of an activated fifth principle, the principle of manas, of thought and self-consciousness. It is involved with a long series of incarnations in bodily form, allowing it to undertake the uphill journey back to self-conscious reunion with the oceanic spirit from which it arose. Manas descended as lower manas through the brain and senses, allows us to perceive and act as creative, responsible agents in the world. To reason, to choose, and to reflect upon our choices, yet tainted by its too close association with the planes of matter composing its temporary, periodical vehicle on Earth. It becomes forgetful of its origin and true identity. It becomes entangled in the dark labyrinth of separative and self-seeking personal consciousness, firmly based on the tripod of ignorance, desire, and delusion. It thereby blocks the free flow of the higher divine radiance within us and repeatedly forges the chains which bind us to blindness, error, and suffering. The mind is therefore both our link to the real and the great slayer of the real. This is why the cleansing or purification of the mind is a core theme found in every spiritual tradition of mankind. That is why whatever else human beings undertake in the world, whatever feats of intelligence, imagination, or creativity they perform, unless they also undertake a path that progressively cleanses the mind in the service of humanity, those actions will be ones which bind them to ignorance and suffering. There are many paths to cleansing the mind. There are many ways to God, and although the means vary with each pilgrim, the end is one for all. On the path of renunciation, it may also be said that the beginning is one for all. The very first key to mental cleansing is the key of Dana, charity, and love immortal. This involves the unlocking of the human heart, the universalization, tough word for me, and purification of motive. Thus, in Mahayana Buddhism, every form of practice begins and ends with the fervent prayer, whatever good may arise through these efforts, may it be given for the benefit and awakening of all sentient beings. Likewise, the voice of the silence asks, hast thou complied with all the rules, O thou of lofty hopes? Hast thou attuned thy heart and mind to the great mind and heart of all mankind? For as the sacred river's roaring voice, whereby all nature sounds are echoed back, so must the heart of him who is in the stream would enter, trill in response to every sigh and thought of all that lives and breathes. The authentic interior invocation of universal brotherly love naturally ellipses the petty voice of self-love and self-concern. It calms and tunes the emotions to a higher noetic vibration. This purified mode of force and expansive heart light unites us with the deeper currents and purposes of life. These alone can guide us through the darkest valleys and are at the same time what lends spiritual sweetness and grace to every step. To realize at the beginning the continuous effort required, says Robert Crosby, would be discouraging. Therefore, both patience sweet, that naught can ruffle, as well as detachment from pleasure and pain, success and failure, are needed. Simple emotional remorse and regret are often ways of solidifying our identity and futile preoccupation with the errors, stains, and pollutions of the personal self. Instead, a calm perception of the core affliction is needed. And a mental calling up of the opposite is what is effectuous for its removal, says Patanjali. Deeply cut mental grooves, attachments, persistent obsessions of the lower ego, lethargy, and all other obscurations to awakening can be overcome by consistently applying the corresponding antidote whenever the maladies arise. We must saturate ourselves with pure alaya, become as one with nature's soul thought. At one with it, we are invincible. In separation, we become the playground of Samarita, which is the origin of all the world's delusions. Meditation is one key to mental purification. Yoga, as defined by Patanjali, is the hindering of the modifications or stilling of the ripples on the surface of the thinking principle. To be steady and authentic, this practice requires a withdrawal from mundane thoughts, a letting go of the endless preoccupations, anxieties, doubts, antipathies, and frustrations of the personal ego. Manas must disengage from the lower astral plane and from kama in order to enter the heavenly gates of buddhi-manas. The voice says, the self of matter and the self of spirit can never meet. One of the twain must disappear. There is no space for both. Once having touched the peaceful, egoless, free space of Akasha, we can descend again in thought into our own seemingly small spheres of duty. By doing so, we begin to clear the channels through which divine knowledge reaches the lower mind and transmutes the very substance and life atoms through which the mind works. Although the ideal is ever receding, and although in action we are riddled with faults and karmic limitations of all kinds, nonetheless, the universal Buddha nature is, by definition, always and everywhere relevant. Because we are mind beings linking heaven and earth, such work is innate to us and can become as natural as breathing. Nature has intrinsic cycles. Utilizing the natural rhythms of the day, the seasons, and the cycles of the year, we connect with an ageless drumbeat. For example, meditation is most easily sustained at dawn and dusk, where we enter the soft, numinous half-light that continually encircles the globe. Likewise, self-study is encouraged in preparation for that purifying withdrawal into sleep, which nature affords all mankind on a nightly basis. To self-consciously harvest the good and acknowledge the errors of the day from the detached standpoint of the soul clears and prepares the consciousness to benefit from the peace of deep sleep. Also, to meet like-minded friends, to raise questions and share insights is helpful in sustaining the higher currents and ones that blends individual with communal education, purification, and renewal. In closing, there is no task more difficult than taming, subduing, and purifying the mind. There is also none more necessary or nobler. Better than a man who conquers in battle 1,000 times 1,000 men is he who conquers himself, said the Buddha. He indeed is the greatest of warriors. Although exceedingly elusive and beset with obstacles, setbacks, and challenges on ever more subtle levels, the cleansing of the mind and heart can be done, and it has been done. Those who have fully and permanently delivered themselves from all the impurities, defilements, and afflictions of the personal ego await to greet us on the other shore. They are an ever-present brotherhood, inseparable from the halls and storehouses of wisdom into which we will enter. They have left behind a well-worn trail and many words of wisdom to guide us on our way. So once again, today's topic: slaying the illusions of mind.
Thank you. Well, a lot of information was just given to us. And has just been given to us. And we think, the last, in one of his closing remarks was said, there is no task more difficult than taming, subduing, and purifying the mind. There is also none more necessary or nobler. And he mentions about the masters, our elder brothers, and how they have been able to do it. So the fact that they have sent an example for us would be a clue that indeed it is possible that we can subdue the illusions of mind. It is something that we all know is necessary, that we need to take care of, especially in today's world. There are so many distractions, as we said initially. And in order to live a happy life, we are given, and the Voice of the Silence, this little book, has an awful lot of information that does give us cause for hope. So we will take your comments and questions, JCS.
Well, is the goal to lead a happy life?
Well, we think the goal, and many times in the readings, it says the goal in life, and basically the only way to progress is to help others. And we speak of universal brotherhood all the time. And that is how we begin our spiritual path. And actually, that was, we have a couple questions to pose to the group. And one of them was, why? Why do we need to subdue the illusions of mind? And as was just asked, is the goal to be happy? We have a question from Theosophy Hall.
Hello, everyone. During the discussion of the Sevenfold Man and what the gentleman was saying about the importance of keeping our bodies healthy and our minds healthy, I'm provoked to think about the present situation and the pandemic of 2020 and 2021. And I want to ask the difficult question, a question I don't know the answer to. But if we were to discuss our interaction and our an objective approach to the virus, what part of the sevenfold man would the virus be able to subdue, and wouldn't the subduction of the illusion, and from our perspective as an individual or as theosophist, wouldn't that be something that we should be using our minds and our talents on? Just to think about that for a moment and think about the answer we can come up with that. Because I often approach the virus as I accept that people react to it, and I accept that people have gotten sick from it, and I accept it's reality for every reason, it's real for them. But all reality is illusionary at the same time. So what is that thing, that essence, that particular idea that allows it to subdue some people's physical state and others pass right by and does nothing? I mean, it might be a deep question, but I think it's well within the grasp of theosophy, honestly.
So we think what the question is, how is it, I mean, in regards to the sevenfold nature of man, when we're looking at the idea of illness in general, not just this particular virus. Why do some people seem to manage not to get sick and others do? Does this have anything to do with the sevenfold nature of man? Is there a theosophical idea to it? Our take on that is karmic. That we are born into a body that has, you know, karma affects us physically, mentally, and psychically. And we are born into a physical form that has brought the essence from past lives into the present. So whether we are a strong body or a weak body, that would certainly affect us, how our body reacts to illness. Plus, there's also how we treat that body. Are we eating properly? Are we getting any exercise? Are we drinking enough water? There are just so many aspects that can affect our physical form. So yes, it is definitely a theosophical aspect when we look at it, and we think the idea would probably be mostly karmic in nature, if anybody else wants to add to that, but we certainly think that karma is the major player here. We have another comment in the back from Theosophy Hall.
Yeah, this is a multifaceted question, and it's really, really intriguing. Now, whether we get sick or we don't get sick, of course, depends on our karma and our constitution, but we cannot exhibit symptoms but pass them on to others who have compromised systems. So many people are irritated or annoyed or don't see the relevance of it, But if we really are, if we are thinking of others first, then we, it's like, well, we're supposed to be other-centered in a sense. So taking precautions can keep them alive and healthy, whereas it may not affect this particular individual, it can affect others. And you know, it's psychic, it's physical, it's and we're not a medical professional by any means, but that's one aspect. We don't want to get too far afield, but that is one aspect of it to be considered.
Yes, the comment having to do with the idea that there, it is a multi-faceted idea that was just brought up, and that it does take a group, it does take, you know, a community to take precautions on some end, on one side, and to prevent somebody else from becoming sick. And when we're, JCS?
Well, without getting into side issues of current events, can we tie this back into the assigned topic for today, which is illusions of mind? So theosophically speaking, the philosophy would not support mental practices to try to heal disease, like Christian Science and other techniques, mesmerism or hypnotism, but rather the clearing of the mental illusions, if one is sick, is to look at motives in the moment and to try to create a detachment to the conditions being experienced. Is that right on point or no?
No, yes, we were going to bring it back to the illusions of mind as well, because we know that if one's mind is full of extraneous objects, thoughts, that sort of thing, it was mentioned in the beginning, it says the objective world may be compared to a great bazaar in which desire enslaved minds, knowing the true prices of things are taken in, have to bargain, haggle, and to wrangle for things needed. So if we're looking at these, this idea of all this stuff, then we're not paying attention to others. We're not really paying attention to ourselves. So when we are constantly looking outward at things, or if our minds are impacted by so many things that are going on and not really thinking well of ourselves, then we know, I mean, science has told us that many, if somebody is very stressed, that it can affect the physical form. So these illusions of mind do that. These illusions of mind can create stress in the human form. So that's another reason why it's important that we try to slay these illusions, not only because it's important for, because if we're focused on ourselves, because we're not feeling good physically or mentally, then we are incapable of helping others. Because we know it's always said, if you can't help or love yourself, how are you going to do it for somebody else? So it is important then how we treat ourselves. And so we think that answers one of our first questions. Why is it important to slay these illusions of mind? Is to keep ourselves healthy physically and mentally and psychically. SL. unmute.
To go back to the first question about is the purpose of life to be happy? And yes, in a sense, but we misunderstand it because of the illusion in the mind that we are separate personal physical beings. And so we try to find that happiness by the preservation and the satisfactions of the desires of that person we identify with. And therefore, the happiness we find is purely self-centered and is not enduring. But there is a bliss and happiness that comes from looking within to self-reliance, to finding what's meaningful in the highest sense to oneself and living accordingly. And we think that's one of the most interesting aspects of this pandemic, that the isolation that practically everybody has experienced in one way or another has forced them to examine and say, all these things I thought I needed to be happy, to do, to get out and be happy. Now that I can't do them, it forces me to reevaluate. And those who still crave those things have not handled the pandemic very well. But those who have found more enduring things, or things they can share with their family and those they love, or develop themselves in some way, or have been able to adapt to a higher purpose, they have prospered, even though the outer conditions have been difficult.
Yes, and unfortunately, we know that the isolation has affected some people in a negative way as well, especially if they've had some kind of, a psychological issue, that the isolation really has affected them. So we know it's gone back and forth, but the illusions of stuff is, we think, is one of the main issues when it comes to happiness, because we know that having a lot of stuff isn't going to make one happy, because it's all objective. We need to bring it back inward and try to be happy with ourselves the way it is. So how do we go about doing that? I mean, we were told in the talk, all the readings, it says this is, we need to become other-centered to other people. We need to try, and it talked about slaying the slayer. That lower mind is what is the idea that will take over higher mind if it is not kept in check. So how is that done then? How is it managed to keep ourselves centered? How do we stay centered? SL?
Often the question comes up, why do theosophists focus so much on study? Is there not a meditative practice? Are there not practical altruistic concerns that can be done for the world? Of course there is. But the study is important first because it brings us in contact with self-evident true ideas, which we can test, check, and verify for ourselves and compare them with the ideas we already hold. And that allows us, through that familiarity with theosophy and the ideas we hold, to begin to analyze and understand what we do think. Because until we recognize our own preconceived ideas that govern our actions, we can't make the step towards improvement, to purification. We have to know what the problems are first.
That's definitely one of the things that we have to do, is we have to become aware that there is a problem. that we do need to change. And then when that happens, I'm having problems with the... Sorry. And then once we can make that adjustment, then hopefully, you know, then we'll know how it is that we have to change. But that awareness is tough. We really need to understand and try to think of how things could be made better, that we could be happier. Having billions doesn't necessarily make us happy, but we can be happy if we are happy and make more spiritual within. Once we start to read the books and take in those ideas and meditate on them and doing the review at night to see where maybe we could have done better, oftentimes will help us sleep. It was spoken of sleep, how important it is. So we know that if we go to bed with a clear mind, which is something that the review will help, it can make quite a difference. And we have a question here in Theosophy Hall.
I was just going to respond to what you're asking about, what kind of different disciplines we can do in order to improve ourselves. And Steve covered most of it, honestly. But just to further the idea, I think, as it's written in the Gita and as also written by some Sufis, they talk about the soul and being like a mirror almost. Like as if we reflect the world around us, but at the same time, we are a reflection of it and all that sort of thing. And that sometimes these disciplines or these learnings, the things we learn from reading books or getting involved in physical disciplines or arts and that kind of thing, serve to be a spiritual filter so that we can see the difference between the real and the unreal as it relates to us. And it's important to have a polished sense of self, to have yourself be as clean as possible so that we, as a lens, can better help the humanity and better usher them in towards the philosophical ideas that are important to us here. So to reapply that back to what we were talking about earlier as a topic, it's important that we rise above materialism, even in a biological sense, because we need to realize that the biological is, if one thing, it's just one category of mm-hmm. a way to understand reality. And then secondly, it's definitely in the lower levels of the sevenfold man. It's something that manifests as a result of how well we're receiving the spiritual information, how well we're interpreting it for ourselves, and then how well we interpret it in reality, in the existential reality, or the bigger general reality. And I think it's important as theosophists that we, in terms of health, realize that our interpretation of things around us have everything to do with our health. Mm-hmm. And that if we can focus on the higher levels of thinking and get beyond material representations of this or that filters, that our way of filtering things with theosophy is a much more powerful, I would say, antidote or cure for the ills of society than to develop some kind of physical representation of those ideas.
Yes, thank you. So basically, we're looking at trying to build up our spiritual nature when it, in order to help ourselves physically and spiritually. MDW, we apologize. The way our computer is set up, we can only see 5 people, and unfortunately, you were on the opposite end, and we apologize. So we would just ask for the future that if anybody is not being called on after having their hand up, please jump in and let us know. Go ahead.
Well, we just wanted to thank you for helping us become virtuous and have patience. And so everything is working out for the best. The idea that keeps on popping up is what are we shown first? What is most important for us to understand? So in the very first chapter of The Ocean, what did they talk about? They talk about masters. They talk about perfectibility. They talk about the journey that mankind is on and what becomes, you know, that we have a goal in mind. And we all have goals, but when we expand those goals, you know, we have a goal for a lifetime, and perhaps many lifetimes, you know, to, you know, help, you know, and by helping, one serves his fellow man, his brothers and his sisters, because we are all brothers and sisters.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I have to say in that.
Okay. Well, if I've been talking over you, is there anything else you would like to add?
No.
Okay. So, yes, the masters were mentioned, and they were mentioned in the talk as well, that they are the example for us to, that they have slayed the illusions of mind. And they have been able, it doesn't mean that that lower mind is gone. It just means that they have been able to control it. They've been able to raise it up and transmute it. But we know that mind is dual. So this is our goal. This is our goal to get. I'm sorry. Somebody say something.
SL.
Oh, okay. SL.
Please finish your thought. I think MDW was just referring that I had my hand up before, but.
Okay, thank you. So the masters then need to be our example. And so that it's something that we can attain. Of course, it's not something that happens in one lifetime. We know that. Nature always works in slow ways, and we have, you know, we can progress and fall back and progress and fall back. But things, you know, at some point, if we are focused on doing for others and having highest motive and are doing our duty without anything in return, at some point in time, we can progress. SL?
Just to go back to the previous question, or what are some of the steps we can take towards slaying the illusions of mind? And the first one, of course, was being aware of the problem. For the second one, though, it's amazing how much time we spend every day cleaning. We clean and wash ourselves in the morning. We clean our bedrooms, our clothes, our dishes. And yet the next day we have to do it again. So if we just apply that to the mind is like our clothing, our environment. It needs to be cleaned. In the voice it says, the mind is like a mirror. It gathers dust while it reflects. So the first step is recognizing the dust. Separative, the false, the ideas we want to get rid of. And then, just like we do every day, when we become aware of them, to sweep them away with what we've studied, with the basic fundamental principles and ideas of theosophy that we recognize. Sweep those ideas away, discard them, recognize they were there, but get rid of them and replace them so you can live according to them for that time. And as they pop up again, when we have to clean again, we don't give up on the physical plane, and we have to learn not to give up on the mental plane either.
Yes, we always seem to forget that it's important, that this is one of the important things we need to look at on a consistent basis. meditating in the morning, it said, and trying to focus on the higher throughout the day. One of the things that is mentioned is like when we're preparing a meal, not think of it as a drudge, but think of it as a gift that we're giving to ourselves and to our family, and recognizing how that food got to us. So, you know, there are so many things that we can do during life to help us remain in a spiritual frame of mind. And we have another question from Theosophy Hall.
It's a comment.
Comment.
So in The Voice of the Silence, it talks about anything that has a beginning and an end is a womb of pain. And if we're looking outward, if we're looking for personal selves, for the personality, to make the personality happy, we're never going to be truly happy. The self shining sage is one who has transcended all that and is looking to serve. And that true happiness comes from within, and then it can be, in a sense, transmitted, as it were, to those in the environment. And the sage knows how to help as well. When to help, when not to help. You know, action in the Gita, seeing action in inaction, and inaction in action, which is a great meditation.
Mm-hmm. So the idea can be that if we are happy with ourselves, then we are able to transmit that outwardly to others. And we all know how much happier and how much more content it is to be around people who are happy. It brings us up as well. So if we can bring ourselves up, we can help others. MDW, I see you.
Well, happiness has everything to do with the attachments that we have. So if we renounce all those attachments, can't we be happy?
If we renounce the attachments to objects of sense, can't we be happy? Is that the question?
Well, even objects in terms of mind, of attachments to people and things, yes. But even to ideas.
Well, it's the attachment, we think, has to do with if it's an obsessive type of an attachment. We can certainly, you know, a loved one we are attached to, but if we are overly attached to that person, that is not good. But if we love them for themselves and we allow them to grow, that would certainly be an appropriate type of attachment of love. But if we supposedly love them so much to the point where we're not going to let them do because we want them to be near us, then that is the wrong kind of an attachment. We have a couple minutes left. So one of the things that we had thought about during the preparation for this class was, all right, so we have slayed the illusions of mind. So what happens afterwards then? And our thought, now we only have a minute, but our thought would be that's when we start to live for others. That's when we start to look inward at ourselves, yet outwards we're looking at universal brotherhood. And we do have one last reading to close. And we just want to say we will try and get this computer fixed so that we get to see everybody. So how could man epitomize cosmos if he did not touch it at every point and involve it in every principle? If man's being is woven in the web of destiny, his potencies and possibilities take hold of divinity as the wolf and pattern of his boundless life, why then should he grow weary or disheartened? Alas, why should he be degraded, this heir of all things? So we have the possibility not only to do great things, but to be great in our own spiritual life. Thank you, everyone, and hope to see you Wednesday. Thank you.